Welcome back to another episode of the Poor Pearl's Almanac. Today's episode is a follow-up to last week's content on Masanobu Fukuoka's natural farming method. We're chatting today with Eric Texier of Brezame Vineyards in South Central France, a traditional forgotten until recently winemaking region of France. What makes Brezame Vineyards special isn't just its ancient history and the unique soils found there, but the stewardship of Eric Texier. His focus and trust in allowing the landscape to function as an ecosystem has paid dividends, rewarding him with high quality beyond organic wines and a vineyard that is more prepared than most for the future climate change is bringing. Talking with Eric was like talking to one of those old family friends whose wisdom doesn't come across as preachy, but reminds you of how little you know about the world and how exciting that learning process can be. Brezame wines can be found across the world, and if you're interested in learning more about his low-impact approach, you'll truly appreciate this discussion. Eric, thanks so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into winemaking?
Well, that was a while ago. I'm not sure I remember right. But for sure, I was a passionate drinker. I loved drinking wine, discovering wine. And after a few years working for the nuclear industry, I wanted to be outside, to have a different life. So I asked myself, what could I do? And there were a few options, and among them, winemaking. So I went back to school. That was in 93. And I did some internship in Burgundy. And after that, I decided that it was a good idea. So I started 5 years later in 98, first buying grapes and making wine. And then quite fast, I decided to work my own vineyards because I was not very pleased with what I could get in terms of farming practices from the people I bought the grapes from. So yeah, 2001, I started to farm by myself in a tiny little place in the Northern Rhone called Brezame. So that was the beginning of the story.
Awesome. One of the things that stands out about you is your land management practices. You've mentioned in interviews that Masanobu Fukuoka was an influence on your practices. And I kind of wonder, how is that taken in terms of like the wine industry when you started doing this? Because wine vineyards are so meticulous about like sugar content in grapes. And your response was basically, the land knows best. So what was kind of the response to that when you started getting into that?
Well, you have to realize that back then, so that was more than 20 years ago, almost 30 years ago, there were still two kind of people making wine in France. Extremely traditional farmers and more modern farmers, if I can call them farmers. And their approach was very, very different. The traditional, what I call traditional farmers, were practicing vine growing the way it has been done for centuries. So modern approach was not part of the picture for them. They were still farming with very, very frugal means, maybe a tractor, but certainly not like a very modern tractor with very modern tools, certainly not with chemicals. And I trained with the two kind of these people. So I trained with one that was already 80 years old. So back in 93, so he started growing vines and making wine between the two wars. And he was really farming and acting and doing his wines the way it has always been done. On the other hand, I went to places where people were more modern in their approach. So I could, you know, I could decide in a way, what do I want to do? And by far, the traditional approach was very dear to my feelings. I felt much better with these people than the people who train as winemakers, who practice like, you know, engineers more than farmers.
Yeah.
Again, I was not the only one around doing what people have been doing for years.
Yeah. What's,
so the thing is, at my age, most, like a vast majority of the people would do the modern way.
Yeah.
So the only thing was that my friends were 40 years older than me. But they totally understood what I was doing. And of course, because it was their life. It was not like a cultural shock. We cannot say that. It was more like a relationship, I don't know, parents to kids. I was the kid, they were the parents.
It's like going to your grandparents. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, it's funny how things that are old become new again. And I think my grandfather made one. He had a vineyard in southern Italy before we moved to the United States. And he would still make wine in the basement. Obviously, he couldn't, in New England, we couldn't grow the grapes that he had in southern Italy. So he would get the juice and or the grapes and he would press it himself with his old press. And when I started making wine myself, you know, as a kid, I didn't really pay attention. I didn't know what he was doing. And when I started getting into making my own wine, making my own beer, and I would talk to my dad because my grandfather had passed. And I would say, oh, you know, what do you know what he did for yeast? And he's like, he didn't add any yeast. Like it was all natural. Like, and growing up today, it's almost like you start with like the traditional conventional methods of doing things. And then you start to learn that that's not actually traditional. This is something that's happened in the last 30, 40, 60 years where we don't, or we control every aspect of the production line versus working with nature, letting the wild yeast come in, allowing for the regional's flavor, a region's flavors to impact what the wine's going to taste like. That was really hard as somebody young and like I'm reading all these books and it's like saying you have to do these things, you know, pay attention to all this different stuff. And then the previous generation was just kind of like, why would you pay attention to it? It's going to work. And there's a sense of, I think, power involved in that where people want to have that power over the landscape, and giving that power back to the landscape can be really frightening. But also something you probably have experienced is that it's empowering in some ways to have that trust in the landscape that it's going to do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is like the opposition between farming and working land and making wine almost as a food processed.
Yeah.
So the farmers, for them, making wine was just like, what, 5% of their time? And mostly it was the end of a process that started with pruning, and they really didn't pay too much attention to wine making for itself. It was just the result of 9 months of work. And if everything was done correctly in the vineyard, then winemaking was just the end of the whole process. It was not a goal by itself.
Absolutely.
So learning from these people, for me, I realized later, and especially when I came to the US meeting my customers, I realized that winemaking there was like a big thing, something that seems very like sophisticated and difficult for most of the consumers, which was not the case back then in France. People wouldn't ask, are you using a new oak or new oak? People didn't care. They didn't even care about the grapes.
As long as it tastes good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for me, it was kind of natural to step back into the old school farming and winemaking.
Yeah.
It was not like a very special move or whatever.
Yeah.
I was not rich. I didn't get my vineyard from my family. So there was not like a financial pressure behind me. Huh?
Yeah.
So it was kind of natural to go the easy, natural way.
Yeah. In some ways, it's the inverse of, like, you know, you have this idea of you're going to open a start a vineyard and you have to do all these things to do it right, but also taking your hands off of so much of the process. One of the things you've talked about is you've tried a lot of different techniques and some have succeeded and some have failed. So I was curious about maybe what that looks like today, maybe some of the things you thought would work when you started and you hadn't had a lot of experience. Anything that stands out in particular?
Things have changed. When I started, I would say that we couldn't sense yet the global warming, climate change. My practices, or what I realized I wanted to do as farming practices in the vineyard was more about ethics. I didn't feel comfortable using herbicides or pesticides because I could realize easily that was, all these techniques were designed to obtain high yields and big money from the same piece of land. And I was not into that. I didn't make wine because I wanted to be a millionaire. I wanted to make wine because it was fun to be outside. I loved the product. So why using all these hardcore techniques if I just needed to make a few thousand bottles of wine, not millions? If my customers were more interested in the way the wine was made than the price of the wine. So my ecosystem, in a way, was not asking for financial or yield performance.
Yeah.
I was not pushed by that, okay? So at the beginning, my main concern was ethics, not polluting, not killing the soil, not killing the vines, not changing vines every 10 years because they were dying because too much was asked to them. So I would say that 2003 was the first time where I realized that maybe it was not just about ethics, but it was also probably about surviving at one point. And then 2009, and well, the real beginning was probably 2009, when we realized that we had in the Northern Rhone is not a Mediterranean climate, or it was not back then. We had quite cold winter, lot of rain, warm and sunny summers for sure, but definitely not like Sicily. But starting in 2009, rain started to almost disappear during the growing season. So conditions were drier. Vines showed signs that they were struggling at one point, what we call a hydric stress. We had things that I've never seen before, except in 2003. It was a sunburn on skins. So after a while, I realized that probably some very traditional techniques that I've been learning from my old school masters back in the 90s was not up to date if I wanted to take in account the climate change. So a lot of things that I did for the first 10 years working in the vineyard changed afterwards. Huh? Like when I started farming, plowing was kind of a big thing, yeah? Especially in the northern part of France. Well, no, also in the southern part of France. But instead of fighting weeds with chemicals, the traditional way was plowing. Plowing under the rows, but also between the rows. And well, 2003 was the first time I saw that it was usually, it was considered that plowing during summer was as beneficial to the vines as watering in a way. And then in Austria, I realized that maybe not, because I noticed that some vines, after like a very light superficial plowing, starting to show signs that they were a bit under hydric stress. And 09 confirmed that. So starting in 09, I decided that I should work on something different than having like a clean, totally weeded soil under the rows and between the rows. And so at that point, I already started to experiment, but I did a large scale experiment on growing a cover crop between the rows and not plowing during the dry season. Then I also realized that it was not that simple, that using recipes that I saw in Alsace or in Burgundy or in Beaujolais, where people were already doing this kind of practice, it could work sometimes on some places, but it didn't work other times and on other places. So that the cover crop thing would be like a huge piece of work to understand exactly what I could do, what I should do, when, how, what plant I should grow. So I started to experiment a lot of different things according to the type of soil I had in the vineyards. So that was the first move, was trying to get rid of the plowing, keeping cover crop between the rows full time.
So did that involve trying to find more native plants to cover crop with? Was that more successful?
Yeah, exactly. So I worked a while on which plant, on which soil, because I have two different sites on both sides of the Rhône. One is limestone and clay, where the vines are not suffering from hydric stress as bad as on the other side of the Rhône, where I have granite, like deep granite, decomposed granite, with no clay, so nothing to retain the moisture. Mm. So we started mostly to see the blend of three type of plants on the limestone in Brézem, mostly legume. So most of the time, like peas, faba, then a grain that could be rye, that could be all type of wheat, different things, and one radish usually, or a beetroot.
Yeah, get the layers.
Yeah, to make like a volume of organic manure.
Yeah.
This worked very well in Brézem, at least until 2018. I could say that we found a very good balance between the cover crop and the vines. But on the granite side, it was a very, very different situation. So no way we could keep first, it was almost impossible to grow a radish or beetroot there. The soil is too light. So unless you water like crazy, you don't get anything. You get like a few leaves, but you never get like the root.
Yeah.
Then we discovered also that in terms of legumes, some were doing much better on the granite than on limestone, especially lentils. Something, I don't know the name in English, called fèvrole. It's kind of a faba, but not exactly. It's not used for human food. It's mostly used for animals.
I think we actually call it the same.
Ah, okay. Certain types of fèvrole did much better. And the grain, it had to be rye, in fact. The only thing that would grow was a specific varietal of rye that they grow traditionally in Brittany on granite. And so we had to find something to replace the radish and faba. And that took a while before we found a solution that is kind of a weird solution. It's not a radish or a beetroot. It's a flower that does like a rhizome.
Yeah, like a tuber.
And as soon as you cut the flower, the rhizome will kind of decompose. And that was the only thing that could survive on the granite long enough to make a root, like a big root, to make quite a comfortable amount of organic manure. And that was not too tough on the vines after the beginning of the vine growing itself.
Yeah.
Because we found some radish, especially some kind of Japanese radish that did well in the granite, but was too tough as its demand in terms of water was too tough for the vines after mid-April, beginning of May. Yes.
Yeah.
So it took some adjustment, and then the hardcore global warming hit starting in 2018. And we have to redo it again.
Huh? Yeah.
So we're working on different type of things. We also are working. So I was like direct seeding. I was not plowing for seeding. So I had like quite a heavy cover crop. So it's fine on the limestone, but again, on the granite, it's more difficult than this. So on the granite now, we are experimenting some grass that you find around the Mediterranean coast, mm-hmm. different types of grass that include like a specific type of mint, thyme, mm-hmm. and to do like a very light cover crop with those plants and to seed into it one row out of two and to start again to do some very light superficial plowing at the very beginning of July, end of June, beginning of July. We realized that, to give you an idea, for the nine first months this year in Ardèche, we had less than 5 inches of rain.
Oh, wow.
For the first 9 months. Huh?
And you said usually you get about 2 feet, right?
Yeah. So it's extremely low now during the growing season, and we have to be extremely careful with the competition between the cover crop and the vines.
Yeah.
Well, at least before we can find solutions on the rootstocks, maybe using rootstocks that are less demanding in terms of water. So we have to work on both sides, the vines themselves, but also the cover crop and the soil.
Yeah.
So this is under process. I have no answer.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
We're still working on it for sure. It's like a big thing for the next 10 years. But we have to reconsider a lot of things. We have been reconsidering a lot of things for the past four or five years. Yes.
Yeah. I feel like you would think with the wine industry where grapes are so sensitive to change that it would be a hotbed of research for dealing with climate change because it's so quick. My cousin also works in wine in California, and she's like, you know, the future of California wine is just like, it's going to be totally different than what it is today in our lifetime. The types of wine, the quality wines, the hotbeds of where wine comes from, all of those things are going to change in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to see that very quick understanding in the wine community, while even in agriculture, it doesn't seem to be changing as quickly as a whole. And I think seeing folks like yourself doing this work, it provides a lot of optimism for figuring out some of these solutions where you're seeing it and you're making those changes today. And especially folks like yourself that are working to do it in alignment with nature and nature's needs. I think that's really important.
Thanks for tuning in to the Poor Pearls Almanac. We've been exploring new areas of content, including new podcasts such as Tomorrow Today and the Gastropocene with yours truly, but also building a network with folks like Death and Friends. We're also building gardening resources and have a bunch of other content coming in the future. If you'd like to get more information or to sign up for our newsletter where we announce new projects, head over to poorproles.com and click on the Our Email List tab. The email list is only used for important, newsworthy content, and we won't clog your inbox, and you'll get less than 6 emails a year. That's poorproles.com at the Our Email List tab.
One of the things I've heard you talk about too, and I think I'd love to hear your thoughts about it, is that you don't use livestock in your vineyards, which is something that's becoming more common here in the US. And your reasoning is that your soil is rich enough. I'm interested to know what you mean by rich enough, and kind of if that's now with climate change going on, maybe changed your thoughts a little bit.
Well, by seeding plants, especially legumes and plants that do quite a big volume of roots, as soon as they decompose, so you need to have a soil that is really alive, you produce a huge amount of available food for the vines. Huh? We know now that by seeding something like 50 kilos, I'm sorry, I will use the international system in terms of units.
Our arbitrary measuring system.
Yeah, by using 50 kilos on 1 hectare of vines, 50 kilos of seeds, we produce with a normal rain during the winter, we produce something around 10 tons of available organic manure for the vines, which is huge.
Yeah.
So we don't have, except these seeds, we have no need for external input. So we don't use compost. We don't use things like this. I hope this was your question.
Yeah, it's answering it. I do actually have a follow-up for that, because I have heard you talk about infusion macerations. And it sounds like you don't use those anymore. And what exactly are those?
Well, are you talking about farming or in winemaking?
Oh, you know what? That's probably what that was. That's why I didn't know what it was. Is because I was like, what is an infusion maceration? I thought it may be like pureeing material and fermenting it.
This is for the winemaking.
Yeah. That makes more sense.
It's one of my winemaking practices, yes.
Gotcha. Okay, so that makes sense.
I don't do any punching down or stuff like this. We do a very old technique called mare immergé. It's submerged cap. So we don't have to use any mechanical means to punch down or stuff like this. And we do like an infusion during the maceration phase.
Awesome.
So this has nothing to do with the farming.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was like, I could see, like, I know, like, maceration can be like in fermented products to put back into the soil. So I was really curious what that was.
No.
But wine does make a lot more sense.
We did what we call a liquid compost for the five first years, because most of the vines that I got back then were chemically weeded for years, for 20, 30 years, and the soil was kind of dead. So to get decomposition of what we seed for the cover crop, we needed to have like a lot of microbes back in the soil. So we did a lot of different teas, what we call also liquid compost, to bring back some bacteria and fungus into the soil. And after a while, you don't need it anymore. It's my feeling, okay?
Yeah.
So we did this intensively for 5 years. And then from time to time on young plantations or things like this, we have to do it again, but it's just a spot thing. We don't have to do it like on a regular basis anymore.
Yeah. Is that something that was traditional, or was that something you kind of learned?
Yeah. That was traditional, really. It was part of the knowledge of very old farmers that were mostly doing farming as for themselves,
yeah.
You know, growing their own food with very, very simple means. And yes, doing these I think the name in English is poison ivy.
Yeah, poison ivy.
Yeah, if you use poison ivy, if you ferment it, if you use it in a liquid and you ferment it for a while, with aeration, you get something extremely alive, full of bacteria and fungus, and it's extremely efficient to spray it on the ground, to bring back life in the soil. And this was a very traditional technique in small legume garden for small farmers.
Oh, wow. Never heard of that.
So these kind of things, very easy to do. You just have to cut the IVs in your garden and to do the fermentation for a few weeks, to do aeration every morning for 3-4 weeks, and you get something extremely efficient and powerful for bringing back some nitrogen and microbes into the soil.
What's that called in French?
Purin d'ortie.
I'm gonna have to look that up later.
Purin is very common in traditional farming, means fermenting things. So you ferment weeds, herbs, you ferment even cow shit. You ferment things like this just to bring a lot of microbes into it, and then you spray it. So it's just a vector for microbes.
Yeah.
So purin is a very, very traditional way of doing things in gardens.
So I've heard of that process from other parts of the world. I didn't know that it was also common traditionally in France. So that's really interesting.
Yeah.
There's something kind of interesting about where you are. You're in a very old part of France that was kind of forgotten as a winemaking country. You've been there for a bit now, and it's kind of come back. And it's really interesting that it's coming back as climate change is forcing the way we've grown grapes to change. And what the ideal, you know, as we call it, the ideal zone for growing grapes is also changing. So I'm a little bit interested to know why you chose where you are, and if you're starting to see other people around you changing their methods to more similar to what you're doing.
Well, I honestly didn't choose this place for climate consideration. Well, not exactly. So I'm not like a big wine guy. Okay, I don't drink 15.5% of alcohol wines. It's not my thing. I'm more a Jura, Loire guy, Beaujolais, but probably not a Châteauneuf-du-Pape guy. So Northern Rhône for me was kind of a very interesting part of France because they had two specific grapes, Syrah, not only two for me. But very specific local grapes, Syrah, which is the local grape in the Northern Rhône. I know that Syrah is all over the planet now, but Syrah is originating in the Northern Rhône. And also for me, Roussanne. And so I wanted to make monovarietal wines. I was more interested in terroir expression. And as terroir expression is concerned, usually, at least when you were trained in Burgundy, you have the conviction that to express terroir in a very deep way, you need only one grape. The good one at the good place, but only one.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you start blending grapes, you could have a huge impact on the style of the wine. And so where is the terroir? You never know. Unless you do the exact same blend, you never know. So I wanted to grow in a place where there was only a very few grapes and one grape per wine. Northern Rhône back then was a quite unknown place. Brézem specifically, it was almost disappeared. And there were opportunities there that I couldn't find, like in Burgundy or in Champagne. No way.
Yeah.
So it was a decent place for me because land was available, still a lot of old school growers I could learn from, unlike Bordeaux, for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, Northern one was, but it could have been Beaujolais, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, still, I decided to go for Northern Rhône, especially Brézem, because in the Northern Rhône, we mostly have a primary type of soil, so granite and schist, and very few limestone. And Brézem is a place that where everything is about limestone. So I had the climate of the Northern Rhône, so continental climate, very cold winter, hot summers, with the soil that you never find in this place. So for me, it was like a unicorn terroir where I could try to achieve some kind of Burgundian Rhone wines. That was the idea at first.
Yeah.
Then the global warming came, climate change. And of course, being on limestone and clay is a much better choice now than being on granite.
Yeah.
So I was lucky in a way, but it was not meant, properly speaking.
Mm. I'm assuming that a lot of the farmers that were there when you started are not there anymore.
Hey, of course.
Since they're old, or they were older. Are you seeing people move into these farms and these vineyards, managing them traditionally, or did they come with new techniques and maybe with climate change they're reconsidering? Or I've spoken actually with someone over in France, Dr. Kifas, who is a natural beekeeper. And he was talking about how people over there are much more open to treatment-free beekeeping because of the fact that they've seen his successes. And I'm curious if you're kind of seeing that same thing.
No, for sure. First, the thing that is happening now, especially in Ardèche, is that a lot of people who farmed for the past 40 years have no one to take over. So it's mostly young kids who are coming, and they don't come to do industrial farming. They come to do as natural as possible farming and winemaking, by the way. But it's true also for a lot of different type of farming than vine growing. So there is a young generation, mostly in their 30s, who are coming. And so they are doing things very traditionally, I would say, but with the very new approach based on the impact of climate change. So they don't use like robots. It's not a high-tech thing, but also they don't use watering because they realize that it's kind of a nonsense. Maybe it's a solution for now, because we still have a bit of water available. But for sure, 10 years or 20 years from now, it's not going to be a solution. These young people, they for them, solving problems for a short period of time is absolutely not a solution. So they are working long time in a traditional way with a very new approach. So typically, they won't replant, like in Ardèche, a lot of young people are not replanting traditional grapes on traditional rootstocks, because they do believe, they are right, that it's the end. Growing Syrah on granite, on steep slopes, south-facing, it's going to work maybe for 10 more years, but it's the end of it. So they are doing traditionally, but definitely they are introducing new or very old varietals that nobody would grow anymore for the past 50 years. They are, digging into rootstock libraries to find rootstocks that were known for being extremely resistant to drought. So a new approach and a traditional way of doing things.
That's awesome. It sounds like you're pretty optimistic about the future of the region and traditional practices.
You know, I'm an old man now, and so it's a new... I don't work in my vineyards almost anymore, except for a few things, especially prospective. But otherwise, it's my kids' generation who is in charge now with farming. And so I'm surrounded by kids. I'm almost the old white male, you know? And yeah, it's around me, it's all... young people, young women, full of enthusiasm, very well trained, I guess being in contact with this new generation of people who have, I mean, they understand clearly what the problem will be in the future. So yes, it makes me kind of optimistic, because they are definitely not my generation with all these certitudes that we had. I hope it will be enough.
I appreciate it. As someone who's in their 30s, and is trying to reconnect with this, history of my family that, here in the US, I think a lot of it is brushed off as like naive kids that don't know what they're doing. So to hear from someone else overseas that, sure, they may be naive and they may be doing things kind of weirdly, but they're going in and they're trying to figure it out. And there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, sure.
So you do, to get back to your wine, which we really haven't actually talked too much about, you sell internationally, correct? It's in the US?
Yeah.
So I know a couple places near me carry it. Any particular years, varieties that you would say if somebody is not super into wine, but wants to try some of this organic, beyond organic wine, what you would recommend?
So I think we first, there are two ways of drinking wine in my mind. I would say a traditional European way, kind of intellectual, so based on history, the perfect example of these wines is Burgundy. So to really enjoy a bottle of Burgundy, you need to know who made the wine, where does it come from, where specifically does it come from. And it's not like a mile away. It's like a few meters away. Huh? Because one bottle can cost thousands of euros or dollars just because it's 10 meters away from another one that is 50 euros. So this is a very specific way to enjoy wine. And I do enjoy this type of wine and this type of drinking. And of course, for this kind of thing, I think terroir-driven wines are very interesting. So I do have a few very terroir-driven wines, usually one varietal, like I said before. And for me, it's either Syrah for the reds or Roussanne for the whites. And I do it on the two terroirs. So the granite part, Saint-Julien, Saint-Alban, and the limestone part, Brézem. So you can always compare, when I make a wine, you can always compare what the impact of terroir will be, because it's only one varietal. It's made the exact same way, with very few intervention, no additives. And it's, so the main difference is beyond my will, it's the place. So for people who are into this kind of thing, so drinking also culture in a way and history, I would say that the Syrah-driven wines that I made are the best to understand what is terroir and what is my aim as a terroir-driven winemaker. Then there is also another way to drink wine, and this is also a way that I love a lot. It's drinking wine just because it's joyful, funny, because it makes you laugh with your friends. And these are wine you don't want to have to think about the terroir, the place, the grape, the way it's made. No, this is... So in this, I try to make a few wines like this, especially Chafoux and Adèle, who are two blend. No, the Adèle is only one varietal. It's now only one varietal, Clairette. And the Chafoux is a blend of Cinsault, a bit of Grenache still, and a bit of whites also. So it's a red wine with 20% of white grapes in it. And these wines are made for a party. I mean, joy, music.
Casual drinking, yeah.
Exactly. So it's a very different type of approach, except for farming, where we do exactly the same thing. Then the winemaking is absolutely different, of course. The aging also. And again, when I make a bottle of Brézem, I want the people to be able to taste my place, to taste the vintage. How was it? Was it rainy? Was it tough? Was it easy? And this must show in a terroir-driven wine.
Yeah.
When I make a bottle of Chafoux, it's totally different story. I want people to have a good time, not to think too much. I would easily do some kind of tricks to give the wine this type of style, instead of showing the terroir. One example is, I'm not like a carbonic maceration huge fan, but for the Chafou, like in 2021, we had like a difficult year with a lot of disease, a lot of rain. And the wine, if I would have made the wine extremely traditionally, it would have been probably too austere. So I used quite a bit of carbonic maceration this time to make a joyful wine. So as soon as I use this kind of trick, which is not an additive, don't get me wrong, it's only grapes. But if I use carbonic maceration to a certain amount in a wine like Chafou, then I will kill a few information from the vintage of the terroir. I will make it the way it is because it make me please. But by doing so, I consider that I'm killing a bit of information, erasing a bit of information from the terroir of the vintage. But the result is joyful enough so people can pardon me to go that way.
I think they will. I'm not very knowledgeable about wines. I enjoy a good wine, but one of the things that's particularly valuable to me in that enjoyment is understanding that the wine is an encapsulated place in time that can never be replicated again.
Of course.
And that is the beautiful part of it, because you inherently, in drinking it, are respecting that moment.
Yeah.
Because it'll never come again. And that part of the wine, I think, here in the United States is not as enjoyed as much, but I do feel like it is coming back. And that is really beautiful. And I as a drinker, appreciate the work that you folks like yourself put into the process.
Yeah, I think this is also something that I really enjoy the fact that when people make me drink my wine somewhere, I don't know, in Iowa, a wine that I bottled like 10 years ago, it's not my wine anymore. Because some people somewhere at one point moved this bottle from one place to another, took care of it. So this bottle won't be the same than the one that stayed at my home.
Yeah.
So in a bottle of wine, they can be also a huge amount of the consumer input.
Yeah, I've never thought of that.
By attention, by patience, by, you know, something really deep. And for sure, if we compare these two bottles, one that I kept at my place in my cellar, and the same bottle of wine that went through different places, boats, trucks, to Iowa, the result is not the same. So everybody has, like, you know, is doing something for this bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And the result has to be different. I like this idea a lot.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to understand it. Yeah, Eric, this has been a fantastic, really enjoyable conversation. I feel like I learned a ton about wine, and I'm a bit more optimistic for the future, and I definitely appreciate that. If you're ever in Boston, you'll have to let me know, and we'll grab a bottle of wine together.
Oh, sure. I will. And if you come to Charnay, don't hesitate. You can stay here.
Right. I appreciate that.